This is
Essential.
This is Essential Audio.
Welcome to the Money Pot. This is Rachel Morrissey. I am here with Ian Horn. You are not new to our audience at this point, Ian. It was so fun to have you back. I know you guys are planning a lot in Amsterdam, so I know you guys have been working on in a couple of interviews. What is your latest interview that you want to share with us?
Oh, my latest one is a really, really fun one. We were looking at Web3 and the future of the metaverse and a few other things with Ruth Vandhoefer. And she's got a book coming out. And Rachel, I'd like you to count me in on this one because the title's pretty tricky. So if you could 3, 2, 1 me.
3, 2, 1.
Re-decentralization. There
oh
we go.
God.
That's it. It's the new anti-disestablishmentarianism, I'm led to believe. But it's a really awesome take on our relationship with technology in particular and how finance plays into that too. So Ruth is an awesome interview.
Okay, great. Well, let's go into that interview with Ruth Vandhoefer.
I'm joined today by Dr. Ruth Vandhoefer. Ruth, thank you for joining us. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
We're going to break a rule here, because we've often said at Amsterdam and indeed any of our big events, we don't allow introductions because, you know, we expect people to come prepped. We need to know who the people on stages are, but I'm going to allow you to break that rule. Could you give the listeners an introduction to who you are and your credentials and some of the things that you're working on right now?
Yes. Well, I've got quite a long career of more than 22 years in financial services now. I started many years ago with my first job in Germany, actually, because I'm German, working in Commerzbank real estate, which was exciting, but not as exciting. Then I moved to Brussels and I worked for the commission in the famous traineeship. And I spent 4.5 years in lobbying for the European Banking Federation and Payments Council. And these were really the key years when we think about fintech, because I negotiated the first payment service directive, which really opened the floodgates to fintech competition. So I'm quite proud to have been able to lay one of the foundation stones of what actually became a massive explosion of business, enterprise valuations, values, and services, of course, to end customers. And also in those days, we built the SEPA schemes, which of course allowed harmonized payments across the Eurozone. And after that, I thought, Brussels is interesting, but maybe starting to get a bit boring. I want to move to London. So I joined Citigroup in London in 2007 and spent more than 11 years in the global transaction banking business, ultimately shaped my own role, which was a combination of policy, strategy, and really helping the business to be early with new solutions to the market, but equally helping the regulators to understand how to best position regulations early stage so that it works for both the banks and its customers, whether these were big customers or small customers. So I enjoyed those years. I got really into technology, which is one of the key pillars, of course, of Money 2020. From 2015 onwards, I got excited about Bitcoins. I got excited about the technology. I started mentoring fintechs in various accelerators. And really in 2018, when I moved out of the bank, I decided I wanted to do more with the fintech sector. So I kind of have various hats since then. One of them is Gauss Ventures. I joined a small venture capital fund where we really invested in very early stage fintechs. And we did that in a very sort of informed way. We've got a team, including myself, which knows the industry very well. It knows what the pain points are. And so we had quite a lot of success over the years, even if it was a small fund, with the businesses we moved into, such as Curve or Zilch, very early stage businesses at the time. But equally, I decided when I moved out of the bank to be a bit more plural. So I spent some time on the board of LSE Group. I spent time until now, on the board of an Irish bank called Permanent TSB. As a non-executive director, I also joined Gresham Technologies and Aquis, which is a European and UK-based exchange business, as well as RTGS Global more recently as a board member from last year. So I'm having a sort of nice mix of non-executive roles where you influence the growth and development of a business, whether that is still a fintech like RTGS or whether that is a main market listed business like Permanent TSB or Gresham Technologies. But equally, I work with a lot of fintechs and banking partners in a more consulting capacity with my own business, Lexima. And really, there are topics ranging from central bank digital currencies. Yeah, I'm very close to all the European discussions in the ECB as much as the Bank of England, to third-party providers that I advise around PSD3, what's coming next, SEPA instant laws, and how does it impact the competitive landscape in the market? And then also things around, you know, strategic development, what is really next on the horizon for people? How can they rechange their business model to avail of new technologies, but also to think about doing things differently to become more efficient, maybe more closer to their customer, etc.
Wow, Ruth, that is some answer. Like, seriously, I feel like I'm with FinTech royalty right now. So really, really incredible career. Some of the things you've done there, I could pick up on a lot of it, but we don't have time to go through everything. I'm going to ask you a question now, and it's something we're going to come back to later, which is, imagine that I'm giving you a huge wad of money. I don't do this very often, but just imagine half of it, you get to invest in a company that you're going to sell in a year. The other half goes for a company that you're going to sell in 10 years. I want you to think about this and let us know at the end of the podcast where you're putting your money. So you're going to be moderating a panel for us on the metaverse. Now, that is such a great topic. I feel like the metaverse is at once misunderstood, exciting. It's a crazy kind of misrepresented opportunity, but absolutely an opportunity. So for those who aren't sold on the metaverse, could you talk us through it and why you think it's worthy of interest at our show?
Yeah, I think the first thing, as you say, is to demystify it. People need to understand what it is maybe today and what it could be in the future. So a lot of it is, of course, reliant on technology and capability to engage with technology, whether that is maybe 5G as opposed to 4G. So there's a network question around that. There's, of course, the whole artificial reality piece with VR glasses and sort of movement and vision. And the point of the metaverse is to really bring all the senses that we normally experience, maybe apart from smell, into a digital experience, which is first and foremost something that is being tested out for some time in the gaming industry, where people feel that they're alive within a game and they can move. And there are lots of sensors and things. And of course, there's a visual element and a physical element to it. And that's all good and working well in that sector and evolving. But if we want to have lots of people participate in it, we need to be quite aware what this means from a hardware and software perspective. People need to be equipped to, you know, enter this new world, this new digital world. So I think that is one element. That is why at the moment, we are still more talking about gaming. We talked about fashion shows in the metaverse. So there are a number of examples that have been exercised within this digital world. I've seen many businesses from banks to other tech companies to fashion houses have actually sort of planted their little flag in the metaverse to show their outlet and really use it as a marketing channel. Now, I think what we would maybe want to avoid is that the metaverse just becomes another marketing outlet similar to the social media platforms that are really being used quite extensively just for marketing. So I think that should not be the point of the metaverse. The value which in other areas of life is being pointed to is, for example, that you can do education in a more engaging way. If people can't travel to certain places, you can have online ways of digitally educating, including showing physical examples of, for example, in the medical science, how you would, you know, look at a body, dissect it, etc. Of course, nothing will ultimately replace the actual experience, but there are many ways of learning, conceptualizing, and even collaborating when we think about industrial design, which already use the HoloLens and some of those technologies. The metaverse could be a next level where you create these hubs where people can come together from a business perspective and design solutions together without needing to be in one room. So there's an upside to this because we can reduce maybe the carbon footprint of flying around the world. Equally, we have to make sure that with all the hardware and software we're might maybe have to actually purchase to be metaverse ready, we don't end up digging out too many rare earth metals either, because that again destroys the environment. So I think there has to be a very good balance around the whole ESG agenda, environmental, social, and governance, to make the metaverse work well in the future. And I think the other thing that we need to connect is the Web3 discussion, because the whole point of Web3 and metaverse ultimately should lead to us as individuals being more in control of our data and being able to consent to share our data with specific entities and bodies in those digital environments, but not to have those digital platforms take all of our data and basically monetize it on our back, but we don't see anything of it. So I think there's a data privacy, a control, and also the ability to monetize yourself in the metaverse, for example, which are the benefits that the combination of Web3 and metaverse should bring. And of course, a big crux in the whole discussion is digital identity. We have multiple digital identities, but which ones can we use to access certain platforms? We probably have more third-party trust providers that help us to navigate this ecosystem and make sure that our personal data is kept safe and that we only share those elements that we really feel we want to or need to.
So Ruth, you make some really good points there about the metaverse. And just thinking about that, firstly, there's the hardware issue, like you mentioned, it's expensive to actually be able to access this stuff. So is there a risk that the metaverse becomes kind of a playground for people who can afford to play in it? And then separately to that, as you say, brands and fashion are the early kind of use cases for this. So it seems almost like a space for showing off. So how do you think the metaverse is going to evolve beyond that point?
Yeah, I think the question is who drives the evolution? If we are collectively, and if to a certain extent, maybe certain tech players and governments are responsibly driving the evolution together, then I think we can use the metaverse to really beneficial ends, such as education, such as learning, bringing people together. But you exactly point out the risk. The risk is that it becomes a playground for the affluent that can actually afford the access to these tools. And the other thing we haven't even spoken about, which sort of reminds me a little bit of a combination of Minority Report and Matrix, some of my favorite films that I tend to quote in all sorts of papers, is of course that if we sit, you know, there with VR glasses and we get immersed into this environment, which is happening clearly to some gamers today, we sort of lose a little bit time and space. And you end up probably with far too many hours sitting in your little cabin or big mansion with glasses on, as opposed to engaging in a social environment. So we also have to be quite mindful that this doesn't become yet another addiction that we already see with people being on social media and just looking on their phones, whether they're in trains or everywhere else. So I think that removal of personal agency by being drawn into those systems is a very dangerous trend. And I've just read yesterday in the newspaper that China, for example, limits time on TikTok for everybody, and you just can't use it more than 40 minutes a day, which is great, right? Because it sort of impinges on your own development as a young person. And we have to make sure that we don't raise sort of next generations that end up sitting there with VR glasses and wondering whether the money grows on trees. So there's a broader societal piece that we need to be very mindful of as these technology evolutions continue. We have to influence them in the right way. And that means everybody also should have access to decision-making in some shape or form, whether it's via tokens, you know, voting for certain developments to happen against other developments, becoming more inclusive, as you say, at least for those that already have the ability to access.
Really interesting, because again, what you're pointing out here is kind of aspects of decentralization. And at the same time, the idea of limiting gaming time is very governmental. It's almost the opposite of decentralized, right?
Well, I think the decentralization comes back to giving more decision-making, which you could argue if a government centralized says no, that's not great. Now, in this particular case, of course, it is a means to ensure that society doesn't fall down that digital abyss, right? So there are decisions which sometimes can be good if made centralized, if they are in the right interest of society and humans. This one, I would probably say, is one of those. But I'm actually trying to argue, particularly in that book, that actually there should be more decisions that are distributed and decentralized so that we all, in one way or other, become part of decisions and we can shape things going forward, as opposed to being dictated by big platforms, how things work, what we should be playing, what we should be looking at. I mean, if you think about all these algorithms that constantly pinch on us and tell us, why don't you buy this one? Why don't you buy that one? We're fueling sort of our traumatic energy by consuming more and, you know, destroying the planet, as opposed to actually thinking about how we use these technologies to our personal and society's benefit.
Yeah. And quickly, the book, Read Decentralization. I got it wrong this time. That's really exciting. And you're going to be talking about that in the box at the show. I'm really excited for that session. Can you quickly give people an overview of what Read Decentralization means?
Yeah, it's a complicated topic. We built a framework. A friend of mine joined me on this book this time around, and we really tried to define what is centralization and what is therefore decentralization, and how do we, in certain aspects of different silos, whether it's finance, technology, identity, where do we, you know, end up today? Are we very centralized? What does it mean for the individual, for economic performance, for usability? And where do we maybe need to think about adding more decentralization in order to make it more broadly accessible, to allow it to be more self-governed as an individual? So there are various examples that we're looking through. So we are creating a framework around re-decentralization. Then I look at the finance sector, of course, the evolution of money and all the discussions we have today, ranging from cryptos to stable coins to central bank digital currencies. What is all of this going to be? And where is this going to take us as an individual or society? do certain things need to become a bit more decentralized? If we think about central bank digital currencies, it's very centralized and it might not even use very exciting technologies because they could be decentralizing things, you know, that's a great word. I just came up with that. Don't decentralize, you know, some governments may say. But equally, if we think about identity, that's a very important piece, which has to be solid and workable in a Web3 and metaverse environment as well. And today, the national identities are completely centralized. And what you do in the internet space is often centralized on different platforms. So how do you bring that control back to the individual and really allow attributes of your identity to be confirmed by trusted third parties, such as your driving license authority, but make sure that you are in charge of holding the data or using a third party to safeguard the data, but you don't have suddenly an environment where all the data about you has to be out by definition, and obviously third parties then monetize it. And we have seen this with the famous cookie consent. Everything you do on websites, you have to click OK, OK, OK to actually get somewhere. And we're seeing that these consent mechanisms are actually manipulating you into agreeing to share sometimes all of your data. And that is a real problem.
Who do you look up to in your industry?
Oh, I don't like the up looking up and down business. I think I just respect individuals and everybody has some magical things about them.
What was the most interesting fact you've ever heard?
I really love, well, I just mentioned quantum computing. I really love that they've proven entanglement physically with an experiment. You can watch it on BBC iPlayer. I love entanglement because it does truly happen and it happens across the whole universe. And the fact that we now know it does happen explains a lot of things that even happen on our little planet.
Brilliant. From your perspective, what three takeaways do you want our Money 2020 audience to leave with when they see your sessions?
Yeah, I think I want them to be more curious about the actual technology that we talk about. Very often, whether it's conferences or just general industry, the deeper understanding at a technology layer is not necessarily there. And you need to spend quite some time reading things that you might find quite boring, but actually they illuminate how things really work under the hood. So I think understanding the technology itself more, which allows you to understand the potential and also the downside risk, is really important. Equally, always keep a head on and a lens that thinks about how you use the technology to benefit society and to benefit individuals. This is not about money making. This is not about shareholder value. This is also not about, you know, creating more and more for the benefit of more. I think it's clever use of technology and think about how you can remodel your whole business by using technology in a different way. Because I think we haven't yet gotten to a point in the broader industry, whether you want to call it financial services or general fintech, we haven't gotten to a point where we truly create new business models. There have been disruptors for old business models, but they still often run on the old rails of systems. But we haven't really seen that complete new business model evolution yet. And I think that's where people that both understand the technology and understand the need in the market and the vision of how you can do it better, if you combine those two to then think about a new business model completely out of the box and throw away all your other beliefs and just be open for that change, I think that would be a very powerful learning for people to go back and say, actually, we should do this differently.
Love that. And what emotional response do you want someone to leave your sessions with?
Oh, I want them to be thrilled and sort of almost can't wait. Let's write this down. Let's talk to friends. Let's research more. Let's get to that. Let's do it. Yeah, I want them to be energized.
Brilliant. That's exactly what we're going for. That is exactly what we're going for. And what about the place itself? Because obviously Money 2020, as much as I love the content, it's not just about the content. It's about meeting people, networking, being part of a bustling environment. How do you recommend that people make the most of their Money 2020 experience?
Yes, the most important thing, first of all, is navigate the app and make sure that you know who's there, both in terms of the companies who you may want to see. Try to set up meetings early if you can. It's all on the app in terms of connecting with people, but also see like how many of your friends might turn up from different countries. I love those international conferences because you actually meet people that you maybe last time met 3, 4, 5 years ago. So some people might not have returned yet from the sort of the COVID slumber. So I think looking at who's there, what themes are being discussed, building your own timetable before you rock up in Amsterdam is really important because you will need sufficient breaks for coffees and smoothies and sofas and massages, which are all there so that you can actually really take in stuff, have a break and then go again. This conference center is a big one. There's lots going on. So make sure you navigate a little bit, do your own metaverse preparation, navigate the Money 2020 landscape and agenda before you're there so that you're completely ready to go.
Love that. And obviously one of our themes this year is now and next. Now, your work spans a lot of areas. It's not just the metaverse and decentralization like we've been talking about. You're obviously big on payments. I realize those areas bleed into each other to some extent. We're looking for people to pick out a trend that's now and one that's next. So from your remit, from your whole kind of overview, what's the big trend right now?
Well, it's very hard to pitch a big trend because we've seen, I would say the last year, we've seen more evolution in that general digital asset space. That is definitely one where even in a now context, people have mobilized types of stable coins, for example, to really improve cross-border payments to what was that maybe happening 3-4 years ago. So that is sort of a now phenomenon. But then the bigger question is, what is next? How do we change underlying infrastructures cross-border to allow better cross-border payments, which is definitely one of my hobbies, not only remittances, but actually interbank payments, because this influences also the foreign exchange market and how we, even as individuals, get better rates when we want to shop abroad or go on a holiday. So I think there's a lot in the payment space that goes beyond the domestic and that also goes beyond some of the asset classes and technologies we've seen so far. And that's why some companies like RTGS are building infrastructure for that purpose. But equally in the retail space, there's a lot of momentum now around stable coins, maybe in future around CBDCs. Lots of good conversations on that, but it will take time. And of course, we need to make sure that CBDCs don't completely erode the commercial banking sector either, which is one of the big topics that are currently unresolved. But I did point to them in 2017 when I presented my PhD paper to the ECB at the time. So these questions are big and they take time to resolve.
Oh, absolutely. And again, there are incumbents that probably don't want to lose their slice of the pie. And there's various reasons why people are resistant to change, right?
Well, I think that is maybe a very good key takeaway. If people coming from Money 2020 would realize that not only resistance to change is futile, but changing is the opportunity, because we see too much in the old world, people are resistant to change. You're absolutely right around vested interests. And if we better understand, I think the promise of this new world is also more transparency. If we better see where the powers lie and where risk of centralization in a detrimental sense could arise because of power concentration, we're better equipped to tackle that, because that is exactly what is the risk of vested interest. And these will always be resistant to change.
So Ruth, I'm going to take you back to earlier in the podcast now, where I slid that bag of money across the table to you and said you can invest it in two companies. One is a company you want to sell out in a year, and the other is a company you're selling in 10 years. Now let's make that a bit more general. Let's go with a theme or a sector. What are the things that you're investing in and what are you selling in a year?
Yeah, I think I would probably sell payments, just because there's so much going on in payments and the competition will show who will be winning, but equally, there's just too much around, I think, at the moment. When we think about more underlying technology, I'm quite excited about that area. So a lot of people talk about blockchain and making that scalable, but equally, there are new forms of technology called lattice technology, which can also use consensus algorithms and actually different ones to proof of work and proof of stake, where you can achieve scalability like you have in card schemes today. So you can go up to 30, 40,000 transactions in a second. And these would be the sort of underlying interesting technologies that you would want to invest in to create an ecosystem that is ready for CBDCs, but equally for other types of digital asset classes in that space, because you actually need the performance, but equally you need to have them tamper resistant. And I'm quite excited about this area, which I continue to investigate at this point.
So Ruth, thank you for joining us. It's been a real pleasure having you on the podcast and really looking forward to your sessions in Amsterdam.
Thank you.
Thanks everyone for listening. We also want to thank Ruth Vandherfer for sharing her thoughts with us. We appreciate your time.
And if you want to be part of the Money Pot, please send us suggestions at podcast@money2020.com. Don't forget to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts, and we will see you again soon.